know what flannel graph is. Anybody here who's ever experienced flannel graph? Okay? If you were in church back in the 50s and 60s and maybe even the 70s, this was high-tech stuff, okay? Donald Trump, if you can, I think the slide's coming up here, he actually had a flannel graph lesson when he was going to be speaking to some Christians, and they wanted him to understand the Bible stories. So I think that got Photoshopped maybe or something like that. So the way it works, you see, is that you have this flannel background. Why they call it flannel graph, okay? And then they have figures of Jesus and Jonah and the whale and, you know, and Jesus and the 12 disciples and everything like that. And then they put flannel on the back of those, and then because of the flannel background, they stick them on there, and so you learn a story, which was, I mean, it was a great, great thing. We used to have this woman by the name of Florence Bromley, who was kind of the visual arts specialist. She used to come around to churches and camps and speak. And so Florence, she was a specialist in flannel graph, okay? And I can still smell the Kool-Aid and the vanilla wafers, you know, when she was there. But she had this thing where she would put something up there and she'd say, "And you know, children?" You know, remember her voice, long gone. She actually looked a little bit like Miss Aunt B on Andy of Mayberry. It's kind of what she looked like. But there were four words that Florence Bromley never said. You know what they were? Once upon a time. To her credit, she never said, "Once upon a time, children, in a faraway land, children." She knew the difference, you see, between Jesus and the 12 disciples and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, you know. She knew the difference between Beauty and the Beast and Jonah and the Whale. The story of Jesus is rooted in history. Luke, one of the best authors, one of the most prolific authors about Jesus' birth, he told the guy that he was writing to, he said, "I went back and I investigated every single word of this story because I wanted you to be sure that what you were told was the truth." What's interesting in this story is who stands out and who doesn't. He says this, he says, "At that time the Roman Emperor Augustus decreed that a census should be taken throughout the entire Roman Empire. This was the first census taken when Quirinius was governor of Syria." Now, what you have to understand is that Caesar Augustus was a big deal in that day. Everybody knew who Caesar was. And yet what you find is you find that this is the only time he's mentioned in Jesus' story. He becomes a footnote. And I want to talk a little bit today about the world that Jesus came to. You mind if we do a little bit of history? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Pay more attention than you did in history class. Hopefully it'll be a little more interesting, okay? But what you find out about this world that Jesus lived in is that there were people, like there are now, who were a big deal back then, and Caesar was one of them. Now, one of the things you have to know about Caesar Augustus is that he ruled the world of the day. There haven't been too many people down through history that have ruled the entire world, but he did. He ruled the whole world of that day, at least those who knew about him. Okay? Now, how do you do this? Well, raw power. That's the only way that you can extend your power from Britain, Great Britain, to India. He ruled the whole thing, and he was a big deal. It's really interesting when you read Daniel, the book of Daniel talks about this because he lists back 500 years before all this happened, he lists all the empires in the order that they're going to come in. He says there's going to be the Babylonian Empire, and there's going to be the Medes and the Persians, and then there's going to be the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great, and then of course the last one was the Roman Empire. Listen to what he says about it. "Terrifying, dreadful, and very strong. It devoured and crushed its victims with huge iron teeth and trampled their remains beneath its feet." There are people who, you know, this was so true of what the Roman Empire was like that there are people who think that, you know, somebody like wrote this into the text until they found the Dead Sea Scrolls and they realized that all of this stuff had been written long before the Roman Empire came into being. Now, the power behind the Roman Empire and the way they worked their thing is that it was a massive army. And this army was financed by looting and by taxing and by everything else that went on. What they would do is they would come into a country, if it was the United States or if it was, you know, a country in Europe, they would come in and they would basically have a banner that said, "Caesar is Lord." And if you defied that, what they would do is they would basically crush your whole country. Kind of like what Hitler did back in the early stages of World War II. And then they would run it. And now if everybody said, yes, 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 Caesar is Lord, then he would basically, you would become his slaves and he would tax you. Some people estimate that between the temple tax and between the taxes of Herod, we're going to talk about him in a little bit, and the taxes of Caesar Augustus, up to 80% of people's income went into taxes. You can understand why they hated the tax collectors, right? It's a horrible system. Jewish historian Josephus describes the Roman Empire and the Roman soldiers that basically enforced it as being pretty sadistic. What they would do, their big thing was, of course, crucifixion. They would come in, and that was the slave's way of dying. And he said that kind of use their imagination a little bit. They would crucify people. They would nail them to crosses in lots of different positions. And he literally would do this until they ran out of wood or ran out of space. Right outside of Nazareth, where Jesus lived and where his parents were from, in a place called Sepphoris, they had a big city. It was a Roman establishment there. And they went in there, and because of a rebellion, they nailed 2,000 Jewish people to crosses. They could see this from Nazareth. So everybody knew what was going on in that day. Caesar Augustus, at the time of his birth, his name was Gaius Octavius, and he was eventually formally adopted by Julius Caesar. And the Roman Senate then proclaimed him to be the ruler of the empire. He was the first one that had basically ruled over the whole empire by himself. And so they called him Caesar Augustus, Caesar the Great, or Caesar the Impressive, and so on. 9 years before Jesus was born, because of his prestige, the Roman Parliament declared him to be Pontifex Maximus. Anybody know what that means? He's basically the high priest. They had this huge emperor worship cult, and he was the high priest of this cult. Poet Virgil made all sorts of declarations about Caesar. He said, this is the one that is to come. This is the one that everybody's been waiting for. He said, he's going to be the divine king of salvation for whom mankind has waited. That he's going to establish an unending kingdom of peace, and he will be the golden age. He will bring in the golden age for the blessing of a renewed humanity. In 17 BC, apparently, Caesar Augustus saw a comet, and he told his people that it was Julius Caesar, his father, who was being raised and exalted to the right hand of the Father. At that point, it was Zeus. And he said, if my dad is a god, that makes me the son of God. And so he proclaimed himself to be the son of God. Now, look at some of these titles and see if they sound familiar to you, because these were all applied to Caesar Augustus. The one who is to come, the king of salvation, bringing in a kingdom of peace, the son of God, Lord, he will have a kingdom that never ends. Does that sound familiar to any of you? He was the faux Messiah. Caesar Augustus called himself a savior, and so what he would do is he would come in and crush peoples and take over their country, and then he would tell them that he had just saved them, because he brought the Roman peace, which means, you know, you just squash people, and when they're crushed down, you know, they don't have any resistance left, and so you bring in peace. Nobody wants to buck that. Back when all that happened, you know, he had to basically fund his army, and to fund his army and tell them how far they could actually go and how far they could conquer, he had to figure out how much he could pay them, and to figure out how much he could pay them, he had to find out how much land was out there and how he was going to get the money to do it. And so what he did was he came up with a census to find out how many people he had, to find out how many more, you know, countries he could conquer. And that's what brought he and Jesus together. Remember how it starts? It says, when Caesar Augustus was the emperor, that he proclaimed that there was going to be a census. And that was what this is all about. Listen to how it goes on. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and the line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. And while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. And she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. And she wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. Now, Caesar Augustus was one of the most powerful men who's ever existed, certainly the most powerful man in the world of that day. Guess how God used him? Well, he used him basically to make sure that Joseph and Mary got to Bethlehem. And in this whole thing, in this whole Caesar is Lord culture, he becomes a footnote. He becomes a footnote in the whole thing. Caesar would use his tax money, as I mentioned, to pay for a forced peace on people. Jesus, the Prince of Peace, was born in the backside of his empire. How many of you think that he probably got a note in the mail that said, by the way, the Messiah has just been born back in, you know, in Bethlehem and part of your empire and stuff. You ought to know about this. How many of you think he knew about that? I'll tell you what he didn't know. As great as he was, he had not a clue. He didn't know for a minute that one day his birth and his reign would be dated from this baby who was born in the backside of his empire. He's a footnote. Now, if you're Caesar, how do you keep, you know, control over these faraway countries? I mean, because Israel was like 4,000 kilometers away. How do you keep control over them? Well, you bring in somebody who will be under your thumb, and you let them run the people, make sure they're loyal to you, and that's exactly what Herod was. Herod was basically this guy where, you know, Caesar said, I'll keep you under my thumb, and you keep the people under your thumb, and everything will be just fine. And Herod was good with that because Herod liked the power, you see, of being the king of the Jews. Now, the problem was that the Jewish people hated him. He was considered to be a half-breed because his part of him came from Jacob, basically. He was Jewish. And then the other part of him came from Esau. He was an Edomite. And so he had shed so much blood that people were scared of him. And then people were also had to understand his addiction to power. And so he's always shining up to Caesar because that's where his power came from. And he's a footnote too. Listen to what it says in Luke. Luke says, For when Herod was king of Judea, and that's what he gets, there was a Jewish priest named Zechariah. One day Zechariah was serving God in the temple, for his order was on duty that week. What you have to understand is that the glory of Herod's rule, was the temple. He had spent 70 years building this thing. And it was magnificent. I mean, it was one of the wonders of the world in that day. We now can see kind of the extent of it because there's still part of it that didn't get torn down by the Roman army in 70 AD. And we are told that the foundation stones for this thing are 10 feet by 10 feet by 80 feet long. And they still don't know how he got them there. All of the 2.5 million stones it took to build this temple somehow were created outside, chipped away and chiseled away outside of Israel and then brought in. They still don't know how this guy did it. Now, Lori and I had a chance to go to Israel several years ago, and it's really true. They tell you, you know, I went there to walk where Jesus walked, and I saw what Herod built. Because that's exactly, he was a builder, and he did a lot of great things. Paranoia was what drove a lot of what he did. And part of his paranoia was this fortress called Masada. Anybody ever heard of that? It's built on top of a plateau. And he had like a three-story palace up there, and he had a big swimming pool up on top of the whole thing. Now, the problem was that this is a place where it never rains. So he collected rainwater 17 miles away, brought it by aqueducts up to this place, and then put it in these big cisterns that are built into the top of this. I was in one of those cisterns. There's enough water up there to give water for 10,000 people for 20 years, if you can imagine that. Amazing. To impress Caesar, he did something else. The biggest harbor in that day, in the world of that day, was in Greece, and it was like 60 acres in terms of the size. So he decided he was going to build a harbor, and it's 512 acres. He imported cement from Italy, the kind of cement that will harden underwater, and he built this thing, put the cement 80 feet down, and built this wall that was 100 feet thick to keep the sea out. And then you can see it's still, you can see some of it still there. It was a magnificent thing. And he named it, guess what? Caesarea. Because you see, he's still shining up to Caesar Augustus. Matthew says that when the Magi, who were known as kingmakers, showed up in Jerusalem, so you can just imagine this paranoid king. This guy had killed off three of his sons and one of his wives because he was paranoid that they were basically going to come and try and take his empire, okay? So imagine what would happen when these guys show up in Jerusalem and they're walking around saying, where's the king of the Jews? And Herod's sitting in his palace and he's quivering with rage. When he finds this out, he goes out and he slaughters all the babies that are 2 years old and under in Bethlehem. That's the kind of man he was. Caesar Augustus knew of his ways, and you know, the whole thing with, you know, Jewish people don't eat pork. And he said, it's safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son, which is probably true. Isaiah prophesied what was going to happen. He said this 800 years before Jesus was born, for to us a child is born, and a son is given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His government and its peace will never end. He will rule with fairness and justice in the throne of his ancestor David for all of eternity. The passionate commitment of the Lord of Heaven's armies will make this happen. And that's what happened that first Christmas night. In the midst of all these other people who had proclaimed their own greatness, this one showed up. Listen to what Paul says about him. Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything else was created and is supreme over all creation. For through him, God created everything in the heavenly realms and on earth. He made all the things that we can see and the things that we can't see, such as thrones and kingdoms and rulers and authorities in the unseen world. Everything was created through him and for him. He existed before everything else, and he holds all creation together. Nothing else can explain the impact that Jesus had. So how does this happen? How does God show up, the one who created everything, and people don't know about it? Let me read what Paul goes on to say. Though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges, and he took the humble position of a slave, and he was born as a human being. Power is a big deal in our world, isn't it? People get a hold of it, you know, whether it's Donald Trump or, you know, whoever it happens to be. And like they cling to it. And they will hold on to it until somebody pries it out of their cold rigor mortis hands, right? We all like a little bit of power. It kind of feels good when somebody knows our name. We write something and people pay attention to us. When our name shows up at a place and makes us feel kind of warm inside because it's us. It's me. Everybody likes that a little bit. What's interesting, though, is that Jesus, he handed it all over. He handed it all over. See, what you find out when you begin to read the Bible is you find out that, you know, all these rulers and everything, that God sets them up and takes them down at will. He does this recreationally. I mean, God could, you know, just lift the oxygen level 5 inches above our heads and we'd be done. You get somebody like Caesar Augustus, you get somebody like Herod, you get somebody, you know, like, you know, some of the other people that have walked on our planet, like Hitler, you know, and it's like, okay, we're going to just send a little germ your way. Going to send a blood clot your way. Because you see, that's the way it works. Everybody goes down. Caesar Augustus became a footnote. So did Herod. Julius Caesar was stabbed right in the Senate floor and killed right there. Tiberius, he's dead. Caligula, he's dead. Nero, he's dead. Hitler, he's dead. You kind of getting the understanding here of what happens? Everybody dies. And then the power that you think that you have to leave it all there. But Jesus came and he lives on. You would never suspected it. This little band of followers, you know, that Jesus had, you would never suspected that they would be able to stand up to the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire did everything they could to squash them. And they, you know, beheaded them. They crucified a number of them. They stabbed them to death. Nero would take people who were Christians, and he would dip them in wax and burn them in his garden as torches. Sometimes to intimidate people, what they would do is they would take their children and they would wrap fresh animal skins, sheepskins around them, and they would send them into the Roman arenas and they would send the wolves after them. Unbelievable stuff. And you'd think to yourself, nobody would put up with that. And yet within 500 years, what Jesus started took over the whole empire. And now Caesar Augustus, the greatest one who ever lived, is a footnote. You see, that's the perspective that you have to understand about what goes on here. Lori and I saw a show that was put on a number of years ago. It was actually we saw it on TV, and it was skydivers. And so these are experts, skydivers, experts, you know, from the Army, I think, from the U.S. and stuff. So they did this thing that's called the X. So they what they do is they put special shoes on that shoot smoke. I was going to get some this morning, but I couldn't get them. But and so they take these guys way up there and turn them loose, set them loose, and then they go like this, and they form an X in the sky. They calculated it a little bit too close, and when they hit, you could see it. There was a splatter of blood. One of the guys lost his head, and one of the guys had his legs cut off. And it kind of reminded me of the story of Jesus at the beginning when it said that Satan will strike your heel and you will crush his head. See, whenever you have two forces going at high speed and they collide in the middle, there's going to be a problem. It's going to be bloody. He had no idea that God was born out in the backside of his kingdom and that he was going to become a footnote in that kingdom. Herod, big deal. He thought what I'm building is going to last forever, and you can still see some of the stuff. But he's a footnote. And I'm telling you, friends, that happens to every big deal that's ever walked on this planet. Every single one of them. Jesus said, you know, I mean, most of us want something that we've built with our life. Anybody here who's built something with your life? Built a business or built a family or built something? Anybody? Come on. You built something with your lives. I mean, when you build something, you spend your life building it, you want to see it last, right? You don't want to see it crumble and, you know, and find out that you've, you know, put your ladder against the wrong building. Jesus said, if you want what you've built to last, he said, you better fasten it to the rock of my kingdom. To what I'm saying. That love wins. Because if you don't, he said, and when the storms come, and they will come, he said, it'll all be gone. Nobody wants that to happen. Two illustrations and I'm done, okay? Everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. In a previous life, I wrote a dissertation. A lot of paper. 430 pages, okay, of stuff. And probably 100 pages of appendices and footnotes. So when I wrote this thing, like it took me 5 years to research it, you know, and I'm thinking, this is going to change the way people see church. I mean, this is going to, you know, this is like, none of that happened. It was supposed to get published, never got published, and so on. So this thing sits in a box in my office. Do you think the footnotes make any difference now? Not a bit. That doesn't make any difference either. See, you can spend your life doing something. Because this was very important to me at the time. Very important to me. And then you realize how important it really is in the whole scheme of things. And I just want to tell you to take a lesson from history and make sure that what you build doesn't become a footnote. You want to build something that's going to last. And you better have it anchored to the right rock. See, here's my theory, and I think it's right, because I think this is what the Bible teaches. We all have been given a capacity for greatness. We've all been given a capacity to make a difference in the world. And if you think it's by, you know, everybody looking at what you write and what you do and the pictures you take and stuff like that, that's fine. But you just have to take a look at it in the long view and say, okay, I'm going to spend all this time doing this. What is actually going to be left of it when I'm done? Everybody's been given a capacity for greatness. And if you fill up that capacity with greatness, with something that's all about you, all about yourself, then what you end up doing is you're playing Trivial Pursuit. By the way, anybody remember the game, Trivial Pursuit? I got this at Value Village for $1.99, and there are four other copies there if you want to get one for Christmas. This one hadn't even been opened yet. Like, the things are still in the plastic. See, the way this works is that you go, there's this board, you know, and you take this piece around, this little round piece and so on. And if you answer the right question when you get on the place, you know, whatever it happens to be, geography or history or something like that, then you get a piece of the pie, something we all want, right? A piece of the pie. And then if you get all your pieces of your pie, well, then you win the game. So I thought I'd just ask you some of the questions that are in here, okay? So let me just, you know, refer to, just see if you have the answers. What original Star Trek star was formerly a singer for Duke Ellington? Anybody know? Anybody care? Okay. Michelle Nichols, that's who it was. Ta-da! I'll give you another one. Some of you are into sports, especially golfing. What Spanish golfer was dubbed El Nino? Anybody know? There you go. It's good. The king of trivia. Okay. One more. You had to get way more answers than this one, okay? What misguided craft damaged more wildlife than any other oil spill in history? Anybody know? Exxon Valdez. That's right. And my day was a pretty fun game. You know, we spent a lot of time back in the 80s, right? Okay. See, you can abuse power, which is what Caesar and Herod did. You can abuse power, or you can totally misuse it or disuse it. You can spend your life playing Trivial Pursuit. And what you get at the end of the game is, you know, well, you know all the trivia, you know, in the world and stuff, you know. I'll take Texas Singers for 25, Jack, you know. I mean, it's like, who cares, really? And you can do that with your life. I'm telling you, if you hook yourself up to anything else other than what Jesus said mattered most, it's Trivial Pursuit. And that's not what you want with your life. See, when Jesus came, I mean, he was God. I mean, he could have forced everybody to follow him. He could have forced everybody to bow down to him. He could have done that, but he didn't. And it's still in this realm of us choosing with our will to follow him and do something that matters. We're told the end of the story. It says that after Jesus had humbled himself, God exalted him to the highest place in heaven and on earth. And it says that every person on this planet will bow to him one day, bow their knee to him, and declare him to be Lord of all. And that includes everyone. It includes Caesar Augustus and Herod and Nero, Donald Trump. Everybody. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. The point, as I see it, is to bow your knee now before you understand how huge he really is. Let's pray. God, I want to thank you that you have given us Jesus. You sent him to give his life. And when he came, nobody knew. He was born under the horrible circumstances. We would have reported Mary to CAS. But he came here for us. He humbled himself to the lowest place so that nobody would ever be able to say, well, you don't know what it's like to be poor. You don't know what it's like to be called names in school. You don't know what it's like to get oppressed, kicked around, because you do. I pray, God, that you will help us to use this incredible gift that we've been given called life to make a difference and not spend it on something that we think is going to make us a big star and end up just a footnote. We've been given this incredible capacity for changing lives. Help us to use it well and help us to follow you. I'll tell you what Jesus did. This is what the world looked like You knew who the people were because they were at the top. Everything reported to them and so on, they were at the very top of what happened. Jesus came, and what he did was to reduce the whole thing. He came to serve. And that's what he said brings greatness, is serving. We have one shot at it. And so may God use you to make a difference this week. May he use the way you serve and the way that you love, and the way that you help others, the way that you encourage, and the way that you pray for others, and the way you use your leadership and your influence to make the difference in this world that you were created to make. You were created to make a difference, you know. May the peace and the joy and the love and the hope of Jesus that he brought be yours this Christmas. Amen.